Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
I avoid situations that will put me in arguments because it's just something that people have gotten so visceral about.
This election season has put a lot of people at odds with one another, co-workers, neighbors, friends. The other night, I went to a voter engagement event that was hosted by one of Philadelphia's newspapers, The Daily News. There were Trump and Hillary supporters who got together to discuss their vision for the future. And I talked to some of them and they said this has been just a really contentious time.
I don't discuss my politics very often with people because it's going to turn into an argument. You just know it is.
It's just been really negative, I feel.
I've been called an embarrassment to women, crazy, an idiot.
I feel like we can't even have the kind of discussions you would normally have about politics or about how you feel about something in an election because it's just so explosive.
Explosive is a good way to put it, right? There are these deep divisions among Americans that have been amplified and worsened by the rapid-fire news cycle and by social media. But I want to take a step away from all of this fighting and name-calling for a bit and see how some of these tough issues are playing out in our corner of the world, in health and in science. On today's show, we're going to talk about the science of persuasion and meet a researcher who says when people tune you out or don't get your point, the problem is you. We'll find out how heated debates about race seep into the supposedly cool and detached world of medical research, and why some scientists want to eliminate race as a factor in disease studies. And we'll take a trip to the very place that started our country's fierce debates over abortion. But don't worry, we'll keep things cool and calm, and nobody's going to be called an idiot. First up, I thought we should take a look at the complicated and not always pretty relationship between science and politics. Science is not a democracy. One person can prove thousands of people wrong. One study, one good piece of evidence can change everything. But science in this country happens within the context of a democracy, and that comes with some strings attached.
I don't know if everybody realizes quite the extent to which science is dependent on government funding.
This is sociologist Elizabeth Pop Berman. She is at the University at Albany SUNY, and she looks at the intersection of research, economics, and politics.
The fraction of funding that comes from government is generally in the 70% range. And without that funding, the whole enterprise would basically just shut down. So I think people sometimes imagine that universities can just kind of pick up the slack and support the research themselves. But a lot of this just wouldn't happen if the money wasn't there.
Now, a lot of times when I reach out to a scientist, they send me back this panicked email. Oh, I'm in the middle of my grant proposals and I'm in the renewal process. And it seems like their whole world comes to a stop until that grant is renewed.
Right.
And that's usually government money. So what is the impact there of so much of this work being funded by the government?
Well, I think most science in the U.S. has been funded by the government for a long time. I mean, that goes back into the 1950s when it sort of became a majority, the biggest source of funds. But what's happened in the last 10, 15 years is that it's become much, much more competitive. That's not so much because funding has decreased. It's been relatively flat. But science has become more competitive, and so there's all these pressures for scientists to put more grants together. The National Institutes of Health, for instance, if you look 15 years ago, about 1 in 3 grant proposals were funded, and now that rate is down to about 1 in 6. And so when you have that happening, that means that some scientists are spending basically half their time writing grants, many of which are not going to be funded, and it's just a huge waste of everybody's time and everybody's resources.
It sounds almost like when you're a politician, the second you win the race, you have to start fundraising all over again.
Yeah, it's very much like that. It's just this endless cycle.
And Beth also told me that because of the money that's involved here, science studies can become an easy target for politicians.
Like a year or two ago, there was one that came out about a guy who was running shrimp on a treadmill.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
$503,000 to watch shrimp on a treadmill. You know what? I don't care what shrimps do on a treadmill. I don't want my shrimp going to the gym. I want them going to the grill or the oven.
That's former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee making fun of that shrimp study. But of course, it was really about the impact of water pollution on shrimp. But this highlights how defunding science can become a really popular item on a political platform. What's important? What's not important? What is seen as a priority? All that can change depending on who is in office. And like Elizabeth said, this has been happening since the 1950s. Our science reporter, Irina Zhorov, is now going to take us back in time to one of the early examples of politics getting involved in science in a big way.
Imagine Depression-era Alabama.
The Great Depression now is spreading.
A young man named Carl Elliott, valedictorian of his high school, was considering his options as the oldest of nine children on a poor tenant farm in the northwest part of the state.
And there wasn't much of a prayer that he could ever get a college education, but he was determined.
Elliott died in 1999, so that's Mary Jolly, who worked closely with him for many years.
He started out walking down the railroad to walk 100 miles to get to the University of Alabama. He had $2.38 in his pocket.
He made it to the university. He became a lawyer and eventually was elected to Congress in 1948. This is where Jolly, then in her early 20s, joined his staff.
He went to Congress with the purpose of creating a scholarship for students in higher education. That was his motivation.
After the war, with baby boomers overwhelming local schools, many people wanted the federal government to step into education. Back then, the feds weren't very involved in it, instructionally or financially, and the education bills Elliott kept introducing stagnated. Resistance came from lawmakers who didn't want the government to have a say in religious issues, like prayer in school. The other big concern was race.
And always it got hung up on that. But the issue for the Southerners was the issue of race and the integration of schools.
If the feds gave money to states for education, they could require Southern schools to integrate. Elliott didn't support that either, by the way. But then something big happened.
Moscow newspapers were first. Then headlines around the world echoed the news. Russia had blasted a man-made moon into outer space.
In October 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the world's first artificial satellite.
Most important of all were its beep, beep, beep signals. Recorded on tape, they unlocked secrets of space.
It caught the American public completely off guard. Sputnik, circling the globe, seemed a constant twinkling reminder that Americans were falling behind in science, destined to lose the space race. Here's President Eisenhower talking about the U.S.'s inferior science education and low number of science professionals.
This trend is disturbing. Indeed, according to my scientific advisors, this is for the American people the most critical problem of all. My scientific advisors place this problem above all other immediate tasks of producing missiles, of developing new techniques in the armed services. We need science.
Some historians say this was just rhetoric, that Eisenhower knew the U.S.'s defense capabilities, and they were plenty advanced. But Elliott and his co-conspirators didn't waste the opportunity. Mary Jolly was with him when they learned about the launch.
Actually, we were not in the office when it happened. I think we were in South Dakota, as I recall. We were holding hearings about education legislation. And at that point, Mr. Elliott called and said, look, we better get back home quickly. He said, this is our chance to do something.
Elliott and several other lawmakers realized people's fear of the Soviets was far greater than fear of their own government sticking its nose in education.
The Soviets have an atom smasher twice the size of the largest U.S. machine. Red scientists are well paid and given great freedom to communicate with each other and their colleagues abroad. All part of the Kremlin's newest weapon, science.
So they sat down and drafted the National Defense Education Act, NDEA for short. It passed less than a year after Sputnik's launch. The NDEA focused on science education specifically, and that was fine with Elliott, as long as students got money towards education. his biggest compromise was to write in loans rather than scholarships. Some lawmakers thought scholarships were too socialist.
The sun goes down and leaves me sad and blue. The iron curtain falls on this cold war with you.
The bill provided money for science labs in K-12 schools, loans for higher education, and training for guidance counselors to identify gifted students for science tracks. That same year, NASA was born, and money went to the National Science Foundation for research and to train science teachers. Shirley Malcolm was a middle schooler in a segregated black school in Birmingham at the time.
One of the things that was really immediate that we saw in the change was that we had real science being taught.
Empty school laboratories received supplies. Teachers seemed better equipped to tackle science subjects.
There was a greater attention to science and mathematics everywhere, nationally, of course, but even in my little school, we all built our own rockets and started asking questions about being able to escape the gravitational pull of the Earth and things like this.
Malcolm went on to get a PhD in ecology and now works for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She says two major things affected her youth: the struggle for civil rights and Sputnik.
I doubt very seriously that I would have ended up in science had it not been for Sputnik and had it not been for the national attention that something like an NDEA represented.
Congressman Carl Elliott, of course, saw his legacy in the millions of students that had the opportunity to study. The bigger legacy, though, is the federal government's deep, intricate, and some still say outsized role in education and science in the U.S.
Well, I say the little old thing called it a Sputnik, yeah, Sputnik.
That was Pulse reporter Irina Zhorov reporting on a massive federal financial push to boost science education in America. Back then, the fear was to fall behind the Russians, that America would lose the space race. Right now, a lot of people fear that the outcome of this election will impact how or if we deal with climate change. Today, we're talking about some of the deeply divisive political issues that have apparently caused all of us to lose our cool and sometimes our civility during this election season. And we're looking at how these issues play out in science. Race relations have been a huge topic this election cycle. Sometimes they seem to be the main lens through which we see our country. But in the scientific community, there is an argument over how important race really is or should be in research. Joining me now to talk more about that is Pulse reporter Tanya English. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Megan.
Tanya, every time I go to the doctor when I'm filling out paperwork, there are questions about race and ethnicity, mm-hmm. much like the questions we get on the census. Am I white, black, Asian, Pacific Islander? And this also, these racial categories seem to play a huge role in scientific studies. I see it all the time.
Right. And those studies become news stories and those news stories become headlines that we all see. Over the years, I mean, personally, I've reported countless stories about this or that group's predisposition for this or that disease. But I've been speaking with social scientists lately who say that these broad, sweeping race categories don't make sense, and they often lead to misleading science.
How so? In which way?
Well, let's say I'm reporting a story on Latinos who have diabetes. Often we talk about this group as if it's all one thing, a whole big group. But the truth is that the rates of diabetes are different if you're originally from Cuba or if you're Puerto Rican or even if you're an immigrant who got here 2 years ago versus 20 years ago. So I spoke with Mike Udell from Drexel University in Philadelphia, and he's a prominent voice in this debate. And he says there is no biological basis for how we define race.
It's not as if all so-called white people have one set of genes and all so-called black people have another set of genes and all Asians have another set of genes.
Udell and his colleagues around the country want scientists to stop relying on sweeping race classifications. He doesn't want to stop genetic research. It's really important that we understand how people are different at the genetic level. But his argument is that at best, race is a cloudy lens to understand those differences, and at worst, it's bad medicine. Mike Udell says geneticists and doctors can do better.
race has been used to oppress people. Race has been used to kill people. And does science really want to be using a concept that is so historically loaded?
Of course, Tanya, I understand it's a historically loaded concept, but it's also how people define themselves. It's an important concept in our society. Why is this bad medicine?
In part, it's about assumptions. So let's take sickle cell anemia, for example. If you're Caucasian, you could have all the symptoms, swollen hands and feet and joint pain. You go to the doctor, and the doctor might not even consider testing you for sickle cell because he considers it an African-American disease. But really, the trait is not related to skin color at all. It evolved in regions of the world with lots of malaria, and that includes South Asia and the Mediterranean. So you could have ancestors be from Spain and Greece and still have sickle cell anemia.
Sure. I mean, assumptions can be troublesome, but a lot of doctors, researchers, geneticists still use race and ethnicity as a way to kind of fine-tune their research. And when I read these studies, it seems like what they are looking to do is eliminate health disparities and help people get better.
Yeah, I have a great example of that. I visited a scientist who's been thinking about curing cancer since she was a 12-year-old in Catholic school. Her name is Maureen Murphy, and she runs a laboratory at the Wistar Institute. It's one of the big research centers in Philadelphia.
My dream is to be able to tell people this is a drug that will melt your cancer away, of course.
She's trying to better understand why cancer hits different populations of people differently. Usually, that means race. For example, in the United States, Caucasian women are more likely to get breast cancer, but African American women are more likely to die from the disease.
And to date, no one knows why. And I thought to myself, I think I might have the reason why.
Murphy promises to explain that, but first she wants to show me her lab. One whole wall is stacked with glass containers and beakers on shelves to the ceiling. Each workstation is a tall science table with a red biohazard trash bag at the end. And around the room, Murphy's team of young postdocs and junior scientists are busy working on different experiments.
So Matt and Leah have done a very small screen where they're looking for drugs that preferentially kill tumor cells. And basically everything in science is a color reaction, right? Yep.
Research assistant Matthew Rice is loading specimens into an expensive-looking machine.
It grabs the plate and sucks it in.
Grabs the plate, sucks it in, and then if we look at the screen,
dozens of tiny test tubes are filled with cancer cells, and each vial gets a dose of cancer drug. Then we wait to see if the cancer was able to survive the medicine.
You'll see a very bright purple color, almost pinkish.
The team is looking for the best drugs to kill a certain kind of cancer that the scientists call S47. That's the technical name of a gene variant. It's kind of a hiccup in DNA way down below the cell level. The mutation sits on an anti-cancer gene that scientists describe as a superhero tumor suppressor. That gene's only job is to detect cancer and shut it down. But in some people, S47 somehow gums up the works, and suddenly the superhero gene does a crappy job fighting cancer. And it just so happens that S47 has been found most often in Black people.
In about 1 out of 50 African Americans and about 1 out of 60 Hispanic Americans. It's more common in Africa. It's about 1 in 10 in Africans. Caucasian Americans, 0 out of 8,800. So what I'd like to do now is to look at families of African Americans where cancer seems to be stalking that family. Because I would like to ask the question, is S47 the reason why?
Murphy thinks the answer is going to be yes, but she hasn't tested enough people yet to know for sure, to convince her peers, or to get her hypothesis published. Still, for Murphy, it's a heady time.
I view science as a roller coaster. You know, there's the first part where you're cranky and clunky and you don't know what's happening. Right now, for me, S47 is I have direction. I'm going up the hill, right? And then I'm going to find that drug that will kill those tumors tenfold better, and then I'm going to go down the hill and have the thrill.
She says science could be a few inches closer to figuring out why Black people are harder hit by some cancers.
And I think that it's absolutely true that there are genetic determinants of cancer that are ethnic biased. There's no question.
Murphy's great at explaining the complicated molecular genetics, but I stumped her with a basic question.
What is race?
I don't know what is race. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
It's hard, right?
It's history.
Even for scientists who deal in precision and accuracy, it's tough to talk about race.
I guess, you know, the problem is we tread into, you know, political correctness here to some extent.
Cancer researcher Jim Manfredi runs a basic science laboratory at Mount Sinai Health System in New York. He says a good doctor wants to know about a patient's family history of health and disease, and sometimes asking about race is a quick way to get to those answers.
Without explaining, if somebody said, well, is your mother white or black? They'd be like, well, WTF, you know, like, what are you after here? None of your business, right? So I think it has to be, the question has to be framed properly.
Manfredi isn't ready to scrap race from science.
Especially in the case of disease, we shouldn't shy away from discussing this because it's so important to sort this out. My family background is more Mediterranean, and so, you know, I tan, I don't burn. You know, somebody from British extraction burns rather than tans in the sun. Their incidence of skin cancer is going to be higher than my incidence of skin cancer. That's all variance in the population that's genetically based, and you can't ignore that. It just can't be ignored.
So again, Mikan, that's the argument for keeping race and ethnicity in science and medicine.
And Tanya, to go back to the cancer researcher you introduced us to, Maureen Murphy, it seemed like she wasn't concerned with those kinds of arguments. She is really just interested and passionate about curing cancer.
Yeah, whether it's shared ancestry or shared genes, Murphy isn't really too hung up on what you call the people that she's trying to help. She wants to be able to look at someone's genes, know what's gone wrong to give them cancer, and then offer some information for what would be the best treatment.
Tanya, if researchers ever get rid of these broad categories, what might replace that?
So the people that are lobbying for these changes say maybe it makes more sense to ask about ancestry, for example. It might be more relevant that my people are from West Africa versus East Africa.
And that would probably give you a more complete picture of the person, is
right.
The hope.
For sure.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
That's Pulse reporter Tanya English. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott, and today we're exploring some of the divisive issues that have come up during this election season. And here comes another big one: abortion, the right to choose, the right to life. It's an issue that focuses voters' decisions in a big way. But let's take a step back in time to see where this argument started. This October marked the 100th anniversary of the opening of the first birth control clinic in America. It was the beginning of Planned Parenthood, and back then, the big fight was over access to birth control and not abortion. Ponsi Rutsch, reporter and host of the podcast Babes of Science, visited the site to see what happened to it.
Brownsville is hot when I step off the subway on a Sunday afternoon in late summer. The neighborhood has the unfortunate distinction of being called the murder capital of New York City. But that day, the sidewalks are filled with families walking home from church. Once I turn off the main road, though, it is eerily deserted. 46 Amboy Street is a two-story brick building, which would be nondescript, except the windows are filled with bricks and cement.
I mean, I guess I expected there to be, like, something functional at least. It's a out-of-service building.
Nothing I see indicates the significance of the site. It's the birthplace of a national conversation about women's rights over their bodies. No plaque, no sign, no life. But in a 1916 photo, 46 Amboy Street looks anything but lifeless. It's a different building, taller with white walls and an elegant black door. The shades are drawn, but there are women lined up on a bench outside, watching over baby carriages and waiting to see Margaret Sanger, the petite, auburn-haired, 37-year-old mother who founded the nation's first birth control clinic. Inside the clinic, Sanger would talk about contraception, from the cheap and less effective rhythm method to more effective barrier methods, using a predecessor to the diaphragm, which was pretty expensive. Sanger wanted women of all income levels to have access to some form of birth control. But even if you could afford it, using contraception was a moral dilemma.
You know, there's a tension between sex and reproduction that was still going on in this period, that you have sex to reproduce. You have a duty to God, if you will.
This is Esther Katz. She's collected every news article and journal entry she can find from Margaret Sanger, like Sanger's family limitation pamphlet, which she passed out at that first clinic and was considered obscene by 1916 standards, therefore illegal. But illegal or not, Sanger knew that women wanted birth control. Before the clinic, she'd worked as a visiting nurse, mostly delivering babies.
I saw women who asked to have some means whereby they wouldn't have to have another pregnancy too early after the last child, the last abortion, which many of them had.
In the early 1900s, abortion was actually less taboo than it is in many places today. That's not to say that having an abortion was easy, emotionally or logistically. It's just that women didn't have a lot of options. Sanger wanted to give women more options, and she'd seen a system that worked. In Europe, women could go to a clinic and ask for birth control, and it was just given to them. That's when Sanger decided to open the clinic in Brownsville. She recruited her sister, hired a translator, and they posted a flyer in English, Italian, and Yiddish to advertise.
Mothers, you don't have to continue to suffer. Come to this clinic.
That's Esther Katz again. From the moment the clinic opened on October 16, 1916, there was a line out the door. About a week later, a mysterious woman appeared.
And immediately, both Sanger and her sister understood it was a policewoman posing as a potential patient.
On the clinic's 10th day, the police showed up and arrested the clinic employees for obscenity. Sanger refused to get into the police car and instead marched herself down to jail. She knew how to create a scene. She also invited the women who visited the clinic to her trial.
So you had a courtroom full of young mothers with babies crying, and they were testifying. You know, the testimony didn't help her case because they said, yes, she helped me out. I don't know what I would have done without her, which doesn't exactly go to I'm not guilty.
Sanger was convicted and spent a month in prison. But when she appealed the conviction, Judge Frederick Crane broke with tradition. Judge Crane reasoned that doctors are supposed to prevent disease. So if contraception prevents sexually transmitted disease or a dangerous pregnancy, then contraception might be a doctor's best recommendation to keep people healthy. In no way was Judge Crane endorsing birth control, and Margaret Sanger was still guilty. But this was the opportunity that Sanger was looking for. She teamed up with a physician, and in 1923, they opened a new clinic and began legally distributing birth control.
Respectable women, upper-class women, women of status, of wealth, now willing to talk about birth control in a way it had never been discussed before.
Birth control became this big public debate, and not least of all because it was tied up with the idea of who should be reproducing and who shouldn't, controlling people's births, also known as the eugenics movement.
It was absolutely common from right to left. The Socialist Party believed in eugenics. The most conservative parties believed in eugenics. Everyone did.
That's Linda Gordon, author of The Moral Property of Women, A History of Birth Control Politics in America, where Gordon showed that Sanger made alliances with eugenists. Sanger had one goal, and she would associate with anyone or anything to get it. As Esther Katz said, Sanger worked with blinders.
Birth control. Women need birth control. They're never going to be equal unless they have birth control, and that's all she saw.
Nothing can excuse Sanger from working with eugenists. That will probably haunt her legacy forever. Even when people denounced eugenics, as they did once the Nazis adopted eugenics-based policies, they were still talking about birth control. It still helped Sanger.
Because once you begin to debate it, whether it's morally or in terms of First Amendment rights or eugenics or any of those things, you've kind of won a major victory.
Sanger would go on to found the American Birth Control League, and she opened more birth control clinics. Eventually, the league and the clinics teamed up to form Planned Parenthood, which works with about 650 branches in the U.S. today, including the one in Lower Manhattan, named the Margaret Sanger Health Center. For The Pulse, I'm Poncy Rutsch.
Poncy is the host of Babes of Science, a podcast about the scientific contributions of women. Coming up, why America's 800,000-plus practicing physicians are having Election Day angst.
Every day, I'm just trying to learn how to be a cardiologist, and that breadth of information that I'm responsible for is unbelievably scary. So then you add on top of that, learn about the politics of medicine. There's no way.
That's next on The Pulse.
I bring my rules down. Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America, care that never quits.
I'm Mike and Scott. This is The Pulse, and today we're talking about politics in a health and science kind of way.
I'm willing to listen to whatever ideals the gun control advocates have.
I'm not for sending any troops into Iraq, and I will oppose sending any of our people back into Iraq. It was a mess from the beginning.
It will be horrific if Donald Trump gets elected, but I am not at all reassured by the policies of Hillary Clinton, who led us into the...
Those are the voices of Ben Carson, Rand Paul, and Jill Stein. All three are physicians who ran for president this time around, but this is not at all a sign that doctors are political animals. In comparison to other professions, physicians are one of the least reliable groups when it comes to voting. According to a recent study, 1 in 4 physicians didn't vote at all in the past 3 presidential elections. So why do so many physicians stay out of the voting booth? We asked Pulse contributor and internist Netta Freya to find out.
People in my profession aren't great voters. At election time, we turn out in lower numbers than farmers, teachers, and lawyers, especially lawyers. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that fewer than 49% of physicians voted in the 2000 election, for example. That's compared to lawyers, who turned out at almost 70%. With more than 800,000 of us in the United States, doctors could be a powerful voting bloc at election time. So why the apathy?
I think everybody will use the excuse of time, which is fair, but then kind of not so much, because, you know, we can find time to do things that are important.
That's Dr. Nidhi Goyal, a hospitalist and colleague of mine at the University of Maryland Medical Center in Baltimore. And she's right. Lack of time is a key reason doctors give for not voting. Researchers who study voting patterns have theorized that medical schools attract people who like science more than civics, and that many doctors feel like their work has enough social purpose, so they can skip voting guilt-free. As I dig into the topic more with Nidhi, she says she's struck by the tension that can come with politics.
Now, in the current political environment, it can be really challenging to have these discussions openly, and it can become very adversarial. It can feel very personal.
Think about it. Do you really want to know that your doctor is voting for the candidate you can't stand? Some doctors stay out of politics for the same reason, so they don't alienate their patients. When I ask another colleague why we're bad voters, he gives me a reason that the medical community understands well, but that would surprise most of our patients.
From the very beginning, we are not taught anything about the political nor the business side of medicine.
That's Dr. Jeremy Pollack. He's a 32-year-old cardiology fellow at the University of Maryland, and he says physicians don't get many chances to learn about the politics of their profession.
You might have one little 20-minute personal finance class in medical school. You might have a financial advisor try to come get your money in residency, but there is no emphasis. This is not institutionalized as important.
To his point, a recent newsletter from the American Medical Association listed 9 issues that will affect the work and livelihood of physicians this election cycle, including, get ready, Medicare reform, insurance regulations, issues surrounding electronic health records, student debt relief, are you still with me? Telemedicine, prescription drug abuse and addiction, and prescription drug pricing. Yeah, these are not binary topics. They are complex, and they require serious study to understand. And what Jeremy's saying is that despite spending decades in training, when it comes to policy, physicians can feel, well, undereducated.
I think first you have to realize it's daunting. I mean, we're every day, I'm just trying to learn how to be a cardiologist, and that breadth of information that I'm responsible for is unbelievably scary. So then you add on top of that, learn about the politics of medicine. There's no way. So it's this helplessness.
In a 70s-style auditorium on the medical campus of the University of Maryland, a few dozen doctors-to-be are eating pizza and hoping to feel less helpless. This is a meeting of citizen physicians, a grassroots movement that started at Brown University with the mission of helping future doctors better understand those tricky policy topics. One of tonight's speakers is Dr. Clarence Lamb.
You're trying to solve a problem. It's like putting a
puzzle. He's young and energetic, kind of a rising star in the Maryland General Assembly, where he is one of four physicians. After the panel, I asked him why he thinks doctors stay out of politics.
You know, we are very, in a way, linear thinkers. We base all of our decisions, and we try to, on data, on things that we see, on observations. That's not necessarily the case in policy, where you're trying to convince people. And from a physician standpoint, from a scientist standpoint, that's incredibly frustrating to realize that, you know, the data might be completely outweighed by one or two stories.
Lamb says politicians also make decisions based on who shows up to vote.
And if they see that the physician community doesn't come out to vote as often as, say, the attorney community, then they will probably be more likely to listen to the attorney community and to physicians because you don't turn out to vote.
Turns out, taking good care of patients includes showing up Tuesday morning to pull that lever. For The Pulse, I'm Netta Freja.
I'm Mike and Scott. This is The Pulse, and here's how political conversations seem to unfold online these days. Either we agree and all is well, or if we disagree, things quickly devolve into, you're an idiot. No, you're an idiot. Okay, now I'm blocking you. That is, of course, not the most refined discourse. I spoke with Arthur Lupia. He is a political scientist who studies how we talk to one another, when persuasion works, when it doesn't. And here comes the bitter truth. Remember all those people you secretly or openly wrote off as dummies during this election cycle? He says when the other person is not getting your point, it's not them. It's you.
If someone is not paying attention to you, the problem is yours, not theirs, because typically they're paying attention to something besides you for a reason.
Lupia likes to use an analogy. He grew up in the country and he knew the woods behind his house like the back of his hand.
There are places near my house where you'd go and there'd be woods and streams and hills and mud, and you knew where to go and what to avoid.
And when he observes people trying their best to convince others of their opinion, he thinks of those woods. He says it's like trying to lead your friend out of the woods from afar and you're yelling instructions.
Here's what you should believe and here's what you should do. But if you don't know where your target audience, where your intended learners are starting out, you're giving them instructions they can't use, or even worse, you're giving them instructions that if they follow them would lead them to the wrong place. In the same way that if you were yelling in the woods and telling someone to turn left and take three steps, but you didn't know where they are, that person could be walking into a tree or falling into a river.
He says first we should find out where the other person is coming from and then consider some brain chemistry. When we're presented with information that doesn't sit well with us, maybe it feels threatening to everything we believe, our brain freaks out.
The reaction is very similar to this idea of fight or flight, right? So if the information threatens us and we see no way to overwhelm it, we try to run away from it. The way that that manifests is we'll counter-argue it. So like in the political season, for example, suppose someone is liberal and they turn on Fox News and they see Bill O'Reilly or something like that. Typically, you know, a common response is not to listen to Bill O'Reilly and give him the benefit of the doubt, but to try and spend your time counter-arguing why he can't possibly know what he's talking about. So you're trying to distance yourself from him and the information. So if you're presented with a piece of information that's threatening, and particularly if you can't immediately see how it would help you, the typical reaction is to try and diminish it, the information, to try and make it seem small and distant and not relevant so that you can go on and ignore it.
I'm wondering if you could walk me through how we can talk to one another better about divisive issues. How do we get information across? How do we make a point? Let's say you and I meet at a dinner party and you believe in climate change and man-made climate change and I don't. And somehow this topic has come up and now maybe we've traded a few barbs. Maybe we've gotten a little snippy. Yeah. So how do we do this? How do we talk here?
I had an interaction with a leader of a major conservative faith group in this country who asked me almost the same question. He was saying, you know, I'm looking at this literature on climate change, and I think it might be real, but my congregation is so against it. So he asked me, how would you write a sermon on climate change? And I said, well, I wouldn't, because your congregation doesn't see you as an expert. But here's what I would do. Think about the common values of your congregation. Think about a sermon that you give that's about one of these common values. And in his case, it was stewardship of God's creations. So I said, do you have a sermon that you give on the stewardship of God's creations that every year when you give it, your congregation's right there with you? And as you're climbing the mountaintop in your sermon, you feel them going with you. You're stating, this is what we're about. And right at the end, when you're about to deliver the punchline, this is why we, you know, have to be stewards of God's creation, then you mention, and that includes the environment, and that includes what we're doing to the environment and to the climate. We're all responsible. This is part of who we are. So instead of trying to take a conservative congregation and say, today I'm going to lecture you about climate change, instead it's, let's find our common values. Let's find something that you and I share, a priority that we have, and let's build from that. So if it was just you and me, you know, we would be talking a little bit, and I might find that you care about children, or that you care about your community, or that you care about, you know, water or something like that. And I would start with the place where we agree and then try and build an argument from there. And there are great, wonderful ideas and things we could do together that won't, you know, solve the whole set of difficulties or disagreements that we have, but can be a basis for us to work together to improve our quality of lives and those of people around us.
Lupia says the most important thing you can do is listen, not for the sole purpose of jumping in and making your point, but to really understand what the other person is saying. But that sounds way easier said than done. How do you turn off that soundtrack in your head that says, that's nonsense? Oh my God, I can't believe he just said that. How do you stop that?
Yeah, sometimes when you're tired, it's hard to do. You've got to have some adrenaline. You've got to have the ability to redirect your attention and adrenaline. And when you're really tired or if you're hungry, it's like it's really not going to happen. But if you have the ability to kind of to take a deep breath, to take a step away from the hand-to-hand combat and think about, you know, I'm just going to take a step back and think about my objective. My objective is to help my community. My objective is to improve life for my family or for young people or for veterans or for, you know, the elderly or whatever it is. And what can I learn from this moment that helps me be effective? And if that's really your goal, right, then you have the motivation and a little bit of the energy you need to be quiet for a second and to really hear someone else on their own terms.
So in summary, it sounds like changing minds is hard work, but it can be done.
Oh, it can be done. Yeah, I mean, if what you're trying to do is show how smart you are or how awesome you are, it's harder to do. But if what you're trying to do is take a moment that you have with somebody else and build something greater than yourself, either a new understanding or a new way to help other people, then you can do it. You can sit down, you can really listen, you can see, is there something in common that we can build from? And then you go build it.
Arthur Lupia is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. How many times did you hear this line during the election season? I don't like either candidate. But people feel like they have to pick one or the other because otherwise they would be throwing their vote away or end up supporting the candidate they like the least. This is why so many people are hesitant to vote for third-party candidates. One solution being used in a couple of cities is called ranked choice voting. Andrew Stelzer reports.
This is what ranked choice voting can sound like. Listen to Oakland, California City Council member Rebecca Kaplan kicking off her mayoral campaign in 2014.
If anybody out there is a supporter of one of the other candidates, my message to them is not that they're wrong. If anybody out there is a supporter of any of the other candidates, then I will respectfully ask that they vote for me as their second choice for mayor.
Did that sound unusual to you? A candidate respectfully asking to be voters' second choice? Now listen to one of Kaplan's opponents, Libby Schaff.
I encourage voters to learn about all the candidates because they get to cast three votes in this election. I certainly hope that I am people's first choice. If I'm not, I hope I'm their second or third choice.
Schaff ended up winning in 2014, even though less than 30% of voters listed her as their first choice. But lots of people did end up picking her second or third. Confused? If your city doesn't use ranked choice voting, which in some places is called instant runoff voting, That's understandable. So let's try and break down how it works. I called up Todd Donovan, professor of political science at Western Washington University.
It's a method where you have multi-candidates running for one office, and voters can rank their preferences, first preferred number one, next candidate number two, three, etc.
So that part is simple enough. How those votes are counted is a little more complex. If one candidate gets 50% of the vote, they win, just like normal. But if no one gets a majority, the person with the fewest first-place votes is mathematically eliminated, and the votes of everyone who voted for that person first are then reassigned to their second-choice candidates. As the count continues, each person who's eliminated has their supporters' second- or third-place votes reassigned to a candidate who's still in the running, until someone reaches 50%, a majority, and they are declared the winner.
So if you're running for office, then you might not be as prone to attack the other candidates because you want their supporters to at least put you second or third.
Donovan wanted to see if there was measurable evidence that this method of voting made the election process more civil, like it seemed to do in Oakland. He conducted a study comparing how people experienced elections in cities that did and did not use ranked choice voting.
We surveyed voters, and we found that in the cities using ranked choice voting, people had more positive views of the campaign in the sense that they perceived less negativity in the rhetoric of the candidates, compared to similar voters who had experienced a mayoral election using winner-take-all methods.
They found similar results for candidates they surveyed in those cities, which included Minneapolis, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and San Francisco.
They perceived to be less likely to have been attacked by their opponent compared to people who are running in winner-take-all systems.
Even more extreme than an absence of attacks, former Oakland mayor Jean Kwan was actually endorsed by a party that wasn't her own, the Green Party, as their second choice.
It, I think, allows you to go more deeply into policy issues rather than personality issues.
And in turn, Kwan endorsed her own competitors by telling her supporters specifically who she thought should be their second and third picks.
What ranked choice voting did was it allowed coalitions to build. And so I think we were fairly friendly to each other compared to maybe other campaigns.
Ranked choice voting is used in a handful of countries. In the U.S., it's only used on the city level in a few places, although the state of Maine has it on the ballot this November. So could this work on a national level? Professor Donovan says a similar voting system has been used in the small island nation of Fiji to try and heal from an ethnic conflict. The results haven't been great, though, so it might depend on whether we're more or less divided than the Fijians. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
Read all the pamphlets
and watch the tapes.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, a closer look at a common piece of evidence.
We all shed hair constantly all day long, and so there are almost always hairs available at crime scenes.
And what happens when that evidence gets called into question?
It was something that was like worse than a nightmare.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.